From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1992 with a phone call between actress Mia Farrow and director Woody Allen. The two were in the middle of a rancorous custody battle for three of their children. Allen was facing allegations of molesting 7-year-old Dylan, one of the couple's adopted children. And meanwhile, Allen had admitted to an ongoing affair with Farrow's then 21-year-old adopted daughter, Suni. Farrow and Allen had a series of phone calls, which either one or both of them had recorded unbeknownst to the other. Farrow's taped versions still exist, and they are part of a new 4-part documentary series called Allen v. Farrow. As referenced in the documentary itself and in a review in The Guardian, the film claims to be an even-handed investigation of the facts. But many critics, including The Guardian, call it pure PR, stating it omits a lot of content. Some of those omissions include parts of those taped calls. If you watch the episodes, what you will find is the conversations in those calls jump from one point to another, with text referencing that parts happen later in the conversation. Looking at it journalistically, one could claim it's not a full and fair and accurate representation of those calls because it asks the question, what's missing here? Often we hear Mia Farrow, but then we don't hear a response from what Allen said or didn't say. Should the documentary be built differently so it can be judged more accurately? And that's just one example in one documentary. The question could be asked about many different documentaries that aired this year or in 2020. Rolling Stone states that 2020 was a strong year for documentaries, and the trend seems to be continuing in 2021. But as we watch them, through what lens should we view them, especially if they aren't fully transparent in their aims? Now, some are journalism-based. Others are produced as social justice projects. Some are just storytelling. Some are activism. Some combine elements of all of that. How should we view them? Our guests this hour offer their expertise, and we discuss a number of recent documentaries. We always love talking about this subject with Linda Maroney, who's a filmmaker, a director, and a programmer for the One Take documentary film series. Welcome back to the program. How are you?
I am very well and eager to talk about this stuff, so thanks for having me on.
Matthew Mann is with us, a video producer and a documentary filmmaker himself. Matt, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And welcome to Ambarian Al-Qadar, who is a filmmaker and assistant professor in the School of Film and Animation at RIT. We just got Ambarian on, so please, if I have the name mispronounced, Ambarian, please correct me now, and I will be gladly own it. I will say welcome. Thanks for being with us, and make sure I'm pronouncing your name right.
Thank you so much. And that's okay. I completely understand because it's written the way it is. It's pronounced as Ambarian.
Ambarian.
Thank you for asking. Yes.
Ambarian, yeah. Very good. Thank you for being with us. So,
Linda,
as the programmer for the One Take Doc series, are docs sort of on fire right now, or do I just think so because during the pandemic I have no other options and all I do is watch docs?
I think docs have had an explosion in the last few decades, and I think really in the last few years, there's been, with the rise of these streaming services, there's been a huge explosion, and a certain kind of docs that we're really talking about here, right? It's kind of the true crime has gotten really big. These multi-parts or serials have gotten really big, and these sort of celebrity-focused documentaries. But that's only a portion of what's being made. But I think that's sort of where we're the ballpark that we're talking about right now.
I'd like to ask all of you if you had to maybe select one documentary you've seen recently, or just one that you think highlights something enjoyable in the genre. I will say, having watched a bunch, I mean, lately I've watched McMillions. I watched I thought the Tiger Woods documentary series on HBO was very good, and I thought it was very humanizing. I'm on the fence on Allen v. Farrow. I've got some issues with it. We can talk about that. Boy, did I love McMillions. That was just pure storytelling weirdness, a story that I had never heard of. And I'm not sure there was some public good, but it was just great storytelling and amazing characters. So I loved McMillions. I'm probably missing a bunch here. I watched the Britney Spears doc. I thought that was pretty humanizing, too. And I thought that was a good reminder of the way the media can sort of really tear somebody down without understanding who they are and not really showing much humanity. Linda, is there one that stands out for you, or can you tell us what you've been sort of watching?
Yeah, there's a bunch this year. Time is definitely one of my favorite films of the year. It is this beautiful black and white documentary that really humanizes incarceration in this country, and it's poetic. It's really that intersection of art and journalism, which is really the sweet spot for documentary. I think it's really brilliantly made. I love Boy State, which you should definitely watch, Evan. I'm sure you would love that. There's amazing films that are made all the time. But those are two that I would speak about right now.
Okay. Amberine, does anything stand out to you?
I would second Linda. Time is one of my favorite documentaries that I've watched recently, the black and the white, and also the idea of using the black and white as a way to tell the story of incarceration, I think was very interesting. I also watched the Britney Spears documentary that you were mentioning earlier, and I think that's really powerful. And I think for me, I think documentary, when you spoke about the idea of humanizing the human experience and stories when we watch these films, and I think both those films did a great job of doing that.
Matthew Mann, what about you?
Yeah, I will just give the caveat that I have two young children, and working from home basically means I work 24 hours a day, so I don't get to watch as many documentaries as I used to. But I have, we sadly lost Michael Apted, great filmmaker, who's best known for the Up series, which started in the 60s on British television, 7 Up, and just recently before he passed, he was able to finish 63 Up, the latest installment, and that's coming to the U.S. very soon. So I look forward to watching that. I've been kind of catching up with that series, which is great. I second Boys Day. I watched that also. It was very, very good. And then another one that I watched, which I thought was excellent, was the Raoul Peck film, I Am Not Your Negro, which took archival interviews from James Baldwin, as well as some of his unfinished writing. And it was a really fascinating interweaving of some of the different public comments, as well as his this unfinished writing that he had done. So some really fascinating stuff out there right now.
Yeah, interesting stuff all. And by the way, all three guests mentioning Boy State. Everybody loves Boy State, so we're going to have to put that on the list. Rolling Stone's 10 Best Documentaries of 2020. I'll just read their list. And then what I want to do is talk to all three of our guests about how we assess what a documentary is trying to do, maybe even before we watch it. Their list includes The Painter and the Thief, The Truffle Hunters, Gunda, City Hall, Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, Boys State. Of course, it's got Boys State. Dick Johnson is Dead, Time, American Utopia, and Collective. That is Rolling Stone's list. Matt, let me start with you on how we view. So take, for example, what I've been watching along with a lot of people in this country over the last few weeks. We've seen three of the four parts of HBO's Alan V. Farrow. And when the filmmakers talk about it, what they say is this is a comprehensive view of the facts. Now, let me give the caveat and say, I don't have much affinity for Woody Allen the person. I'm not here to judge what happened. I don't want to make this all about that case. And, you know, goodness knows a lot has been written with people who've examined much more than I have. What I will say is this film series is clearly Mia Farrow's side of the story, and that is fine. And that may be a more accurate side. That may be the accurate side. It may not. But it is clearly the sort of the Farrow family story. And just one example of why that is some of her children are featured in the documentary, and some are not. Moses Farrow, for example, is not. He has become very close with Woody Allen over the years. He does not believe Mia Farrow's stories. He stands by his father, or someone who's become a father figure to him. Of course, Suni Previn married Woody Allen, and they are still married, and she has written about what she calls abuse at the hands of Mia Farrow. I'm not saying I know at all what happened in that family. I'm just saying that when you talk to the surviving children, and three have died, when you talk to her surviving children, there is certainly a split about not only what happened, but about which parent is sort of more was more loving or more constructive. It's a very sad situation. There's no way to look at it anything other than a very, very sad family situation. But the documentary series is clearly Mia's side, and that's fine. I'm not exactly sure why the filmmakers say this is the comprehensive version of the facts here. So, Matt, when you hear what a filmmaker is trying to do, or let me actually ask this. Before you even sit down to watch a documentary, is it important for you as a viewer to know, hey, are they just telling me a great story? Is this activism? Do they have a point of view here? Is this meant to be a journalistic enterprise? I mean, how do you even do that?
Well, I would say, first of all, you know, I'm in the midst of watching Alan B. Farrow with, along with a lot of other people. And, you know, I always try to see what is the filmmaker's point of view. And, you know, when I first came to documentary, I think I had this purist view, like it has to be objective and, you know, you have to see the different sides of the story. And I think that certainly is important. That's one type of documentary. But I think, you know, we've come to realize there are other types of documentary. So there certainly are films that are really well done and very provocative that are more of an advocacy type of documentary. And they have a very clear stated point of view. And they're not trying to tell both sides of the story. I think the problem with something like Alan B. Farrow, and I haven't read a lot of what the filmmakers have said about it, but they present it, if they present it as an objective view of the facts, and they're leaving a major part of the conversation out of it, not having a chance to respond and tell their side of the story, that's where the problem comes in. And as a viewer, I think we have to discern whether it's before we watch or whether after we watch or when we're digesting it, what is the filmmaker's point of view? Is this something where they have a particular slant and they're trying to just show us this one perspective? And a good documentary, the hope is that it brings up a lot of questions, and it's just the beginning of your delving into a subject, and then it sparks you to want to go and learn more and research more. A film, no matter how many parts it is and how long it is, can't tell you every bit of information.
Sure.
But what it can do is it can spark that and make you want to learn more. So I think that's on us as viewers to really understand that and to go and delve more into it.
You have I know your work as a filmmaker, I think, is outstanding, Matt. And when you are trying to tell stories through documentary filmmaking, how overt are you with the audience about, you know, what your own point of view is and what your goals are?
Well, I think for the kinds of films that I have typically done, I've done sort of two approaches. One has been where, you know, I will allow the person to tell from their own perspective, and my voice is not a part of it at all. You don't hear my questions or any kind of voiceover or anything like that. And certainly I'm making decisions about which comments are in and which comments are out. Every filmmaker has a point of view that they bring to it, and we have inherent biases. So we have to recognize that. But the other perspective that I take is what I would call something like a first-person narrative perspective, where my voice and my perspective is out front. You know, you think of, there's a filmmaker who became famous for this, Ross McElwee, Sherman's March, Time Indefinite, and films like that. And then somebody like Michael Moore, who is like, he's on screen. It's very clear in that case that this is the filmmaker's perspective, their point of view, and they're presenting it as such. So that, to me, is less problematic because that is clear to the viewer. What becomes more problematic is we talk about a film like The Last Dance, which was, I think, the most popular ESPN film ever put out there. You know, that was a film that, very entertaining, but it, you know, when you look at the credits, it's not clear. But if you dig a little bit, Michael Jordan's production company co-produced that film, and he actually was able to see the entire 10 parts before it aired. And that is something that is very problematic, mainly because that's not explicitly stated to the viewers. So obviously something like that is presented as a documentary. You know, it's going to make the person who has a chance to vet it before it goes out look very good. So we just have to know up front what the filmmaker is trying to do. And it's problematic when it's just not clear.
That is such a good point. I don't know why I forgot Michael, the Last Dance, Michael Jordan's. I mean, it's really supposed to be the story of Michael Jordan and the end of his basketball career. But to Matt's point, yes, Michael Jordan had a hand in the creation of that. And so that's probably okay, as Matt says, but you got to know that as a viewer. And that was sort of masked over. That's a really good point. Umbreen, how do you see the challenge for viewers and what we ought to know as viewers before we sit down and watch a documentary?
I think viewers are intelligent, and that's always my starting point. I also try to understand through my work who is the viewer of my work. And that is a question that is important for me as a maker. I feel that, you know, they're not like this general uninformed. There's this idea that viewers are, and that's sort of also, you know, the history of the of mass communication and educating the masses through the documentary form. But they are smart. smart, intelligent, perceptible, and sensitive body of people. And I think filmmaking, documentary filmmaking, for me is personal. I feel documentaries, documentaries, the relationship that they have with this notion of truth is sort of not not always, documentaries do not always reflect the entire truth. And I think Matt spoke to that idea that they are partial truths. And the audience goes into watching those films with an understanding that, you know, this is not going to be a journalistic article or a research paper on a certain topic. This is going to be a filmmaker's interpretation of how they see the events. So that becomes very relevant. And I agree with what Matt said, that, after you watch a film, that becomes the starting point of sort of figuring out, okay, this is one way of looking at this. What is the other way of looking at it? So, for example, there was a film, The American Factory, that looked at how the car, I believe it was a film about that looked at the relationships between factory workers and they were going to China. There were Chinese workers involved. And when you talk to how the audience here views that film versus when you talk to people, so for example, who have sort of ties to China, I mean, their understanding of that film is completely different because they are viewing it as two different set of audiences. I mean, there are different facets to the story. It is at the end of the day, I think both filmmakers and watching films are both subjective acts. And it's hard to say, and it's sort of problematic to say that documentaries sort of reflect the truth of a situation. They give us an insight into a certain facet of that situation. I must say that, I mean, I have had, you know, I teach, so I've not sort of had the time to quickly go and research into the specifics of the examples of the films that I'm mentioning. So, for example, The American Factory, the film I watched like about three months ago. I watch a lot between documentaries, also fiction, and fiction that is driven by documentaries. So my memory is just going to be sort of hazy in terms of the specifics. But yes, these are all facets, and there are always, and these are sort of opportunities to sort of explore and look more into what this whatever issue a film is talking about.
Linda Maroney, how do you see the role of the viewer, and what can empower viewers who are watching documentaries?
I would say the same thing, that viewers are smarter than we often give them credit for. But I would take a step back for a minute and just revisit the word documentary. It was coined in 1926 by John Grierson for a Robert Flaherty movie. And the original definition was creative treatment of actuality. So it was never, meant, putting a staple saying this is going to be objective journalism. So I think that's something that people should know. I mean, I get so angry when people talk about docs not being movies, because they are movies. I think that's a really good thing. But I think people should really watch credits. I think it's really important when it comes to documentaries. If someone involved in the film, the subject in the film, does have a producer's credit or something like that, then that gives you pause to think about, well, who has final cut? Who is getting the, final say in what goes into the film? So I think that's super important. Going back to Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering, who made Alan V. Farrow. So they have made a lot of films, and a whole section of them deals with sexual assault. They did one about the Catholic Church. They did The Invisible War about the military. They did The Hunting Ground about college campuses. They did On the Record about the allegations against Russell Simmons. And now this one. So this is very much in their wheelhouse. I think there's primarily two types of filmmakers, one that know a lot about their subject going in, and one that is curious and wants to learn more. And I think, I think we can feel which side this one may lay on.
When you are making films yourself, Linda, how much do you take care that the audience knows, what the aim is. Is it journalism? Is it activism? Is it advocacy? Is it just great storytelling? I mean, how important is it to you that the audience would have a pretty clear picture of that?
I definitely strive for honesty in that sense. And films that I've had that have gone through, say, independent lens, there's a huge vetting of, you know, of accuracy and ethics involved. There's pages and pages of materials to be able to get a national broadcast on a major space like independent lens on public television. I would never accept money from someone in the film. I mean, the two hardest things I would say in making independent documentary is getting access to the subject, the amount of access that you want, and also getting the funding that you need to make the movie. So those are the trickiest things. And sometimes, things come at you and you have to take a double take and say, well, you know, what does this mean if I take this money or not from this service? Or organization, foundation, whatever it is. Documentary films isn't always a lucrative sport. So many documentarians make money teaching or making commercials or doing other things as well. But now there is this huge explosion, as we were talking, that that there's more, a larger audience for it and people are coming back. But it becomes almost formulaic in some of these episodes, these episodic films, I'd say. So there's many things to consider here.
Well, that's a very curious comment to me. As I ask our listeners, what stood out to you, especially in our pandemic year? What documentaries were on your radar? What was the best? What did you enjoy the most? What did you maybe benefit the most from? What moved you? Maybe changed your mind or moved you to action? Or did you just enjoy? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Or you can email the program connections@WXXI.org. I really kind of want to stay with the point that you're making here, Linda, on how difficult it can be to get films made here. And yes, in the last year, as all of our guests have been talking about, there have been some very highly regarded documentaries. And yet, here's Samantha emailing me right off the bat saying, I'm shocked no one brought up Tiger King. I mean, Linda Maroney, would the world be better if nobody knew about Tiger King and everybody watched your films or Ombreen's films or Matthew's films? I mean, not to disparage Tiger King, but isn't that a little bit of the junk food in a world where we're just walking right by the salad bar and we're going straight for dessert with Tiger King?
Yeah, it's really funny because I used to say that that documentary used to be the vegetables at the filmmaking table, you know, that it was something that we're supposed to watch and it's good for us and we're going to learn something, but we didn't really want to do it until documentaries really started being as concerned about form as they were about content and make their films compelling and funny and, sometimes sitting at the edge of the seat for the audience to know what's going to happen next. And I think that's changed it. Quite honestly, I haven't watched Tiger King.
Yeah, me neither. Me neither.
So I can't really speak to that one.
I can speak to the reputation of it, and I avoided it at the behest of many people in the listening audience. Though, as I mentioned, I did watch a documentary series that I don't know it's going to change the world at all, but it was totally gripping, and that was McMillions. And that was just great storytelling. I watched that series thinking, I don't know what the perspective of the filmmakers is other than, my goodness, did they get some great characters. You know, and so let me ask all three of you about that. You know, Linda, when you talk about two things that I think really matter here, access as you matter is one thing. Do you have access to the people you need to talk to? Are you willing to compromise on your ethics to get that access, and do the viewers know that? And then what you really need are compelling characters anyway. I mean, so in McMillions, there's an FBI agent who, I mean, he's right out of Central Casting. You can barely believe he's real. And he is real, but I can't, out of 1,000 people you interview, it's probably one who ends up that good in terms of a compelling on-screen character. And sometimes, I'm sure as a filmmaker, Linda, you go, oh my gosh, we got it. Like this, I can't believe this person. So How do you kind of do two things here? How do you make sure that the access of whoever you need to talk to is fair, is ethical, and are there certain bounds you don't cross? And then how do you make sure that the story you're telling has compelling characters? I mean, because some people can't be coached. Some people are better than others when they talk, right?
Yeah. So for that, I would say, you know, now it's very typical to cast your documentary, which seems like an awful thing to say. And years ago, it would have been. But now people often want to make a film about a subject matter or, you know, an issue. And then it's like, well, who can we, you know, capture that would carry the movie, that would be compelling, that people can relate to, that feel comfortable in front of the camera? Because not everyone does, right? So often, you know, you might do a test if you know that that's the route you're going, or you may know someone that is in your life that's incredibly compelling. Often first time filmmakers do something about what they know, and maybe they're related to someone or there's someone in their circle that's fascinating and they have access in that regard. Sometimes access is really, really hard. We made a film about the Dalai Lama, and getting on his calendar was probably one of the toughest things. Mm-hmm. but once you were there, you had it. So that can be really hard. Funding is challenging because although there's more entities, there's a lot more films being made. So when it comes to grants or something like that, you're applying with so many more people than you ever did before. And in this country, you know, we don't have a great setup to support filmmakers like they do in, say, Ireland, is actually really helpful to filmmakers. So it's hard. It's really hard to make your film, although it's cheaper to have equipment and to get equipment. But there's so many more films being made. It's harder to get your film seen in a lot of ways nowadays.
Let me just say, there's a separate Linda in Rochester on the phone. Hang there on the phone. I've got some emails. I promise in a moment we're going to get to your phone calls and emails on this. Last point for Linda, and I'm going to turn to Amarine and Matthew on this. When you are interviewing someone, Linda, for the documentary, I mean, there's always going to be moments, and this happens in radio, if I'm working on a news story, where someone will say something and you go, oh my gosh, like, wow, like it just hits you and you know you've got a powerful moment. There are other times where you feel like they're on the cusp, or maybe you've pre-interviewed them, but then they sit down and they're not as compelling. What is the ethical line in which you can work to get them to give you some compelling sound without coaching them, without giving them a script, and without sort of telling them what to say?
Often you can go back and re-ask that question in a different way. You know, unlike live radio, we can edit things out.
Yeah.
So that helps to be able to go back that way. Often leaving room for silence, people are often uncomfortable with silence, and so they're going to want to fill it. And so their brain will start thinking about whatever it is the question was or what their answer was, and they will keep continuing. So when interviewing subjects, you know, I always make room. You know, it may feel a little awkward in the moment, but often you get really, really interesting points that they have to make at that point because they're trying to fill that space. And, you know, there's magic in documentary. Often we go into making a film and have an idea of what it might be about. And then you realize sitting down with an interview or something, you know, if you're filming unfolding events, something happens that is vastly more interesting than what you ever thought it could be. And then you just have to have the wherewithal and the strength to be like, okay, I thought this is what the film was going to be about, but oh my goodness, mm-hmm. I need to really follow up on this because this is so much more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Amberine, access and compelling characters on camera. How do you do that in a way that is ethical and fair to the viewer?
A lot of research, and a lot of it's a combination of research and approach. I personally feel like Linda was talking about casting, and I'm in the process of in pre-production for a project where I'm required to consider casting, and I feel very strange about that because I also work as a narrative filmmaker, and casting is really a narrative technique. So I feel very uncomfortable about the idea of sort of scouting for the right person who will tell the story, as much as I know that this is really important. I feel that as a way to answer that question for myself, just as a filmmaker, I try to make films from what I know. I try to make personal first-person films that at the same time are also very relevant thematically. They are always stories that are reflecting on larger issues, but I try to make films where either me or the world that I know is reflected through the characters I know. So I do not go out actually scouting characters for a theme-based film that I'm doing. That's mm-hmm. just the way I work around this issue. I think compelling characters are, I watched Tiger King. There was a conversation on Tiger King earlier, and I watched Tiger King. And I think that really speaks to the idea that documentaries are diverse. There are so many different kinds of documentaries. Tiger King, of course, it did not create the compelling change that we want. And, so it's a film about, we wonder, why are we watching this film? Like, what change is it going to create? But I think it really the film did the work of creating kind of an understanding for a person that, and giving me an insight into the life of a person I might have opinions about. And I feel that the ability of the documentary to really unpack our deepest prejudices against people through telling human stories. I mean, Tiger King is a very, very human story at the same time, though, it does not fit into the box of socially driven change-creating documentaries. Mm-hmm. Because documentaries were never supposed to be only change-creating and socially driven. The earliest form of the documentary, John Grierson's The Night Mail in 1936, was a film that documented the lives of mail workers in England. And even the idea of creative treatment of actuality, John Grierson later realized that Robert Flaherty in Nanook of the North had gone back and refilmed a lot of the scenes for the film by actually asking them to act in front of the camera because the footage was destroyed. So documentaries inherently are... it sounds like a very radical idea, but I believe that documentaries have that space in which they are fictional. There's a certain element of performance and editing. Of course, when you're editing a documentary, you are really making the selection of what goes into the story and what goes out of the story. When you're framing, you are deliberately making the choice to include someone and exclude someone. And all those choices the core of that is who is the person who's making this film. And they're all connected in a way that the question of access and then tying it up with who is this compelling character. I think at the core of that is the filmmaker and what is the philosophy and the political lens of what the filmmaker is looking at the world through. So. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, an interesting point. Matthew Mann, building on what Amberine just told us there, do you think it's important, Matt, in scenes where things are reenacted to at least let the viewer know this is a reenactment? Often it's clear, it's sort of obvious in that way, or sometimes there's a softer lens used. There's techniques to kind of do that. But, an actual reenactment, I think we should at least have some sort of tip-off. Do you agree?
Yeah, I kind of gets back to the earlier point about just having that transparency. I think there are great examples of this that we've taken for granted. But I look back at a film like Errol Morris's film, The Thin Blue Line, where this sort of technique became popularized of filming something that they didn't have any footage of in a very dramatic way. And you watch that film, you understand very clearly as a viewer, this is not actual footage mm-hmm. of this police shooting that the film centers around, but it adds a layer to the film that is very interesting. So I think, again, as long as there's clarity about it, in the case of Nanook of the North, there was a little bit murkier line there because you're going back and you're actually presenting this as documentary footage, but it was reenacted. So I think in the earlier days of documentary, those lines were a lot more blurred. I think now we look a lot more at the ethics of the filmmaker. And so, I think it's important to be clear about that, but there's all kinds of techniques which are perfectly valid. Just understand, what you're doing and why you're doing it, and does it serve the story?
Yeah, I think that's well said. Matthew Mann is a video producer and documentary filmmaker. Ambarine Alkadar is a filmmaker and a professor in the School of Film and Animation at RIT. Linda Maroney, a filmmaker, director, and programmer for the One Take documentary film series that we all love so much. And we are learning how to become better doc viewers. A lot of docs, very, very popular in the last year. Some are doc series, some are one-off documentary films. And these are three great filmmakers and thinkers who are going to help us be better viewers. We're going to take some of your phone calls and emails after this only break. Coming up in our second hour, how do we define herd immunity? When do we know we've reached it? Are all of the vaccines equal products? Why is there so much debate about these issues and disagreement in the public sphere? Next hour, we welcome a doctor who not only works in medicine, he works in educating the public about health matters, trying to clear up any pandemic misunderstandings we have. Next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and a different Linda in Rochester on the phone first. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. This is Linda, and I had to call in today. I love listening to your program, and I usually catch it when I'm in my car. So this question made me feel that I really needed to call because I recently saw the documentary called The C Word, and it made such a dramatic impact on my life in that my first career in life, I had exercise on my job, and not having that and all the different arenas that could get me out and get me exercising the way that I should be to have a healthy life, the C word actually did it. So it's got a few pillars and some tokens to have a healthy lifestyle and think about your life. And it did have drama in it, too. And your guests really open a lot of questions for us as viewers to think about the next time we watch a documentary.
What was your main takeaway from the C word?
That we all have cancer cells already in our body and that we need to make sure that we eat and exercise and do things to prohibit the growth.
But there's money in all the bad things, you know? There's money to be made in all of the bad things that lead there. Linda, thank you. Thank you for the phone call, and I appreciate the kind words about the program. Thank you.
Well, it sounds like what they said is that I have to do my own investigation now that I've seen the documentary.
Well,
that's what you're saying. It may not be true. Huh?
No, well, let me just say here, and I'll let you go, Linda. Thank you for that. Linda Maroney, it's not that I think the takeaway should be that don't believe what you see. It's that I think we should have at least, I think, a pretty good idea about the intentions of the filmmaker and maybe, you know, I guess it's a question of how you build trust. So, you know, I haven't seen The C Word. It's pretty well reviewed. It had some pretty well-known people. Morgan Freeman narrated it. It seems like it's a pretty good project, but I haven't seen it. But what's generally your view for Linda the Caller and others who say, hey, I saw this, I had some pretty good takeaways, but, you know, I want to make sure what you're saying is not necessarily not to trust it. Because that's not necessarily what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I think there's you know, an obligation to the audience, right, that there is truth in what you're putting out as a film, that you're labeling a documentary. You know, it's not propaganda, because that's the other end of the pendulum. I think, you know, whether it's a portion of the truth is something for the audience to consider. You know, you can give five filmmakers all the exact same footage, and they're going to make five completely different films because of what they're bringing to the table. And it may be a different viewpoint in each segment of that film, of those films. So the idea is what's there is probably true in some regards, but there's probably more to the story. Like we were saying before, what was left out? Who wasn't interviewed? Making a documentary is about 8 million decisions, right? Who you film, how you light them, what questions you ask, in what order, what's left out, what kind of music you use that creates a whole emotional level. So I think just remember, it's it's, you know, again, this goes back to media literacy, right? This is the whole thing. Another reason why this should be in our schools. I'm such an advocate of media literacy, but it's learning to read documentaries.
Yeah. And I will say to Linda, the caller, the reason we're having this conversation is because, frankly, I'll be honest, I love documentaries. I mean, I can sort of not get enough of them. And our guests are all outstanding filmmakers and educators in their own right. And so the point is not at all to say, if you see it, don't trust it. It's to say, hey, you know, some maybe are better made than others. And just be thinking about, you know, what you're taking away from it. And if there are any questions unanswered, you know, explore why. But some films, I think, are pretty airtight. I will say my takeaway from the Tiger Woods series on HBO was, I'm not sure I felt like anything was missing there. And I, in a past life, I worked briefly for the Golf Channel in Orlando many, many years ago. And so there are certain people I know pretty well from that film. And I think that they did a really good job making a film that humanized a very complex subject and someone who didn't want a film made about them. So I think it's just trying to be better educated is the point. But hopefully we all walk away from this wanting to see more. That's how I feel. Sarah in Rochester, go ahead.
Hi. I just one is a comment, and then I also have recommendations. My husband and I we're film people, have been forever, and almost every Saturday night, generally speaking, between 7 and 10, we watch a documentary. We don't watch features on a Saturday. We watch documentaries. And that streaming services have adopted, become available at all, but also have gotten on board to documentaries, is a real game changer for us, because we, for years, would read about a documentary that would never come to Rochester. And so we're very appreciative that I get to watch things that would have been in very limited release, but now I can see them, like Period, End of Sentence, a few years ago. Really great documentary. I believe it won the documentary Oscar. But recommendations, Evan, you said you really liked McMillian.
I did.
So did we. And that was an HBO documentary product. So that in particular kept my eye out to other HBO documentaries. There's a new one out right now. It's four episodes, not six, in the similar vein, but by different documentary filmmakers. It's called The Lady and the Dale, D-A-L-E. And we're two episodes in. We're just really enjoying it. Anybody who liked McMillian's probably will like The Lady and the Dale on HBO. The only one we're going to go to a theater to see shortly is The Truffle Hunters. And that's probably so that I can really absorb the Italian woods. I don't want to just see that on my TV screen. I want to be in a theater.
Man, I can't wait to be back in theaters. I am with you there. Sarah, thank you for that. Great recommendations. I hear such great things about Truffle Hunters 2 as a documentary, and I've been on a truffle hunt. I can't wait to see what they've done with that. Let me read a few emails, and then I'm going to kick some questions to our guests from listeners who have emailed. Steve White, by the way, says, my octopus teacher, wonderful. So there's a recommendation from Steve. And let's see here. Boy, lots here. Naomi says, Kiss the Ground, a documentary showing we can reverse global warming by binding carbon in the soil and handling soil in a different way. So there's certainly what I would assume is an advocacy film, and sounds very, very interesting. Kevin says, Evan, I saw Icarus this past year about the Russian doping scandal. Amazing to watch as the filmmaker became wrapped up in the ring he was uncovering and a subject of the documentary himself. Very good. Melanie says, I binge-watched the documentary Pretend It's a City with Fran Lebowitz and found her to be extremely interesting and very funny. And Michael wants to know, I'll kick this one to Amberine. Michael wants to know, no, this is not Michael's email. Boy, there's too many. David says, Sacha Baron Cohen, is he a documentary filmmaker? Are his movies documentaries? Amberine, Sacha Baron Cohen, do you think of Sacha Baron Cohen as a documentarian? I guess I do not.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't create documentary, like he blends, and he's making very real world references through the fictional work he's creating. But the distinction is that documentaries use real life people to tell the story. In that sense, I would not call Sacha Baron Cohen a documentary filmmaker.
Matthew Mann, Sacha Baron Cohen, documentary filmmaker or not?
I would have to categorize him almost more as a performance artist in a way. I mean, he uses elements of documentary, but I certainly don't think he would call himself a documentarian. I heard an interview with him recently, and it's fascinating to hear all the legal things that he has to do to make sure that he doesn't get sued. But he's a provocateur, and he makes some interesting films, but he's really, it's more about his performance and what that elicits from real people.
And Tara says, Evan, do not neglect the local archives. The portable channel collection at Visual Studies Workshop holds more than 900 tapes made by local documentarians from 72 to 86. The portable channel was founded by filmmaker Bonnie Shore Klein, a mother of documentarian Naomi Klein, and just says locally made documentaries matter. Let me ask all of you to weigh in on that. That's a great point here. Ambareen, what do you think?
They absolutely do, and I really commend the One Take Film Festival. This is my fifth year of being in Rochester. I'm from New Delhi. And the One Take Documentary Film Festival and Linda Maroney with the Rock Doc Group, just fascinating to see the conversations and the community, and it's really, really exciting.
Matthew Mann, you've had the experience of creating a documentary and trying to find places for it, and maybe struggling as the big budget, the high wattage films have an easier go of it. What would you say to Tara's note about making sure we keep local docs in mind?
Absolutely. I actually was just wearing yesterday a T-shirt from the One Take Film Festival, Make Docs, Not War. So, Linda, I love the festival.
I might just cry here.
I love the sentiment. Yeah, absolutely. We have to support local filmmakers and local documentaries. I also would like to plug Visual Studies Workshop as an alum of that place. There's such a fascinating archive. I came across film from Robert Frank when he was in residence there. Some really great stuff that we can find locally, both at film festivals and in these archives. So absolutely a treasure.
Mm. And Linda, yeah, this is a love fest. Do you feel in the love at One Take?
I'm pretty much blushing, yes.
Can you update the community on what's next for One Take?
Yeah, it's been a rough year, but hopefully things are going to start opening up, and we're looking to do a smaller festival in June. So that's what we're looking to do, and start opening up the series again when things open up a bit more. But I would plug for Visual Studies as well. They have a great archive, and that's a really other fascinating aspect of filmmaking that's happening now is a lot of archive-based documentaries that are unfurling at the moment. So, I tell all of my students at Fisher to really, download all your materials, right? Because we're all taking documentary stuff so much more than we ever did. You know, we're not just taking out cameras, Super 8 cameras at birthdays and holidays anymore, but we're filming our friends walking down the street and going out and living in a pandemic right now. And who knows where any of this footage is going to end up, say, 10 years from now. So download it all and store it well and safe.
Let me squeeze in one more phone call. Barbara in Brighton, go ahead.
I just wanted to say that as a former middle school counselor all my life, feelings, of course, are very important to me. And Linda, the documentary, Linda, does a really good job of bringing feelings out with her visuals. She does a great, and visuals are nice looking when they're nice looking, but they don't always hit the mark. But she does a magical job of making that bring out feelings in you. So I just wanted to add that to the compliment group.
Well, I know she appreciates it. Linda Maroney, this is too much here. Thank you, Barbara. Thank you very much. Linda, anything you want to add there?
No, I'm just going to go hang out with my teenage sons who will keep me in check.
Oh, yeah, there you go. That's why you have teenage sons, to bring you back to earth. That's exactly right. Ambareen, anything you want to add before we lose the hour about what you'd like to do next in terms of filmmaking?
I am completing a long sort of project that's been going on for a long time. It's a film about a cab driver, and I hope to complete that. A couple of other projects are in early development, and I want to finish that. I want to sort of get back to in-person screenings at the Little, see Linda in person, probably meet more local documentary filmmakers. And thank you for having me here.
Where's the time for all of this? We all need more time, Amberine. The Canadian philosopher Ed Robertson once said, where does the time go when it's not around here? It has not been around here. Matthew Mann, 30 seconds. What are you working on?
Well, as I mentioned, I have young children, so I've taken a little bit of a hiatus from filmmaking, but I've sort of been bouncing around the idea of doing something on Alzheimer's. My father passed away from Alzheimer's in 2018, and I have hours of footage of him. And so exploring the stories around that, there's so many compelling and sometimes heartbreaking stories. So that's something that I've sort of been bouncing around trying to do something with.
I think that's a beautiful idea and maybe a fitting tribute to your family. And Matt, I know you'll do great work with whatever you do next. Matthew Mann's a video producer and documentary filmmaker. Thank you, my friend. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Amberine Alkadar, a filmmaker, professor in the School of Film and Animation at RIT. Our pleasure having you, Amberine.
Thank you so much.
And Linda Maroney, go talk to your kids. They'll bring you back to Earth. But honestly, we can't wait for one take and hopefully a more normalish year and on our way back here. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much, Evan.
So many great docs out there and so many great people making them. All right, more connections coming up in just a moment.